რადიო თავისუფლება FM 107.4.
საქართველოში 14 საათია. მოისმინეთ ახალი ამბების გამოშვება, მას მარიამ ჭიაურელი გაგაცნობთ. ჯერ თავარი ახალი ამბები მოკლედ. ბარაკ ობამა წმიდათა წმიდას უწოდებს აღმოსავლეთ ევროპის უსაფრთხოებაზე ზრუნვას. შეერთებული შტატები გამოდის აღმოსავლეთ ევროპაში თავდაცვის გაძლიერების ინიციატივით. ეს ინიციატივა საქართველოსაც ეხება. აღმოსავლეთ უკრაინაში ინტენსიური ბრძოლებია. სირიაში საპრეზიდენტო არჩევნები იმართება. ახლა ეს და სხვა ახალი ამბები უფრო ვრცლად. შეერთებული შტატების პრეზიდენტმა ბარაკ ობამამ ვარშავაში ვიზიტისას წმინდათა წმინდა უწოდა პოლონეთისა და სხვა აღმოსავლეთ ევროპელი მოკავშირეების უსაფრთხოებისადმი ვაშინგტონის მხარდაჭერას. ამ კონტექსში ობამამ აღნიშნა, რომ უკრაინის კრიზისის მაუცილებელი გახადა პოლონეთში შეერთებული შტატების სამხედრო წარმომადგენლობის გაზრდა. შეერთებული შტატების პრეზიდენტმა ეს განცხადებები გააკეთა ცოტა ხანში მას შემდეგ, რაც ვარშავაში ვიზიტით დაიწყო 4-დღიანი ევროპული ტურნე. ამ ტურნეს ფარკლებში ისეწვევა ბელგიას და საფრანგეთსაც. დღეს ის ვარშავაში მართავს შეხვედრებს პოლონეთის პრეზიდენტ ბრონისლავ კომოროვსკისთან და პრემიერ-მინისტრ დონალდ ტუსკთან. ხვალკი შეხვდება ცენტრალური და აღმოსავლეთ ევროპის კიდევ რამდენიმე ლიდერს. ეს ლიდერები ვარშავაში იკრიბებიან პოლონეთში პირველი პოსტკომუნისტური არჩევნების ჩატარების 25 წლისთავთან დაკავშირებით. სტუმრებს შორის იქნება უკრაინის არჩეული პრეზიდენტი პეტრო პოროშენკოც. შეერთებული შტატების პრეზიდენტი გამოდის ინიციატივით, რომ მილიარდი დოლარი გამოიყოს აღმოსავლეთ ევროპაში შეერთებული შტატების დამატებითი სამხედრო ძალების განთავსების დასაფინანსებლად. ამ ინიციატივის ფონია კრიზისი უკრაინაში და რუსეთის მიერ ყირიმის ანექსია. თეთრი სახლის განცხადებაში აღნიშნულია, რომ შეერთებული შტატების ინიციატივა გაზრდიდა ნატოს არაწევრი ქვეყნების, მათ შორის საქართველოს, უკრაინის და მოლდოვეთის უნარს ითანამშრომლონ ვაშინგტონთან და ნატოსთან თავიანთი თავდაცვითი შესაძლებლობების გასაუმჯობესებლად. ვაშინგტონის განცხადებით, ობამამ შეერთებული შტატების კონგრესს მოუწოდა მხარი დაუჭიროს ინიციატივას, რომელიც ითვალისწინებს ევროპაში შეერთებული შტატების სახმელეთო, საჰაერო და საზღვაო ძალების გაზრდას. უკრაინიდან იუწყებიან ახალ შეტაკებებზე, რომლებიც აღმოსავლეთში მდებარე ქალაქებთან, სლავიანსკთან და კრამატორსკთან მიმდინარეობს. უკრაინის შინაგან საქმეთა მინისტრ არსენ ავაკოვის ინფორმაციით, რომელიც მან სოციალურ ქსელ ფეისბუქით გავრცელა, ძალიან ინტენსიური ურთიერთცროლაა სლავიანსკის მახლობლად. ცნობების თანახმად არის მსხვერპლი. სირიაში საპრეზიდენტო არჩევნები ტარდება. მოქმედ პრეზიდენტ ბაშარ ალ-ასადის ოპონენტები ფარს უწოდებენ ამ არჩევნებს. ეჭვს არ იწვევს, რომ არჩევნები ასადის გამარჯვებით დასრულდება. თუმცა თეორიულად ეს არჩევნები არის პირველი სირიის ისტორიის ბოლო 50 წლიან პერიოდში, როცა საარჩევნო ბიულეტენზე პრეზიდენტობის ერთზე მეტი კანდიდატია დასახელებული. ასადს ჰყავს ორი პრაქტიკულად უცნობი ოპონენტი, მაჰერ ალ-ჰაჯადი და ჰასან ალ-ნური. არჩევნებში მონაწილეობის საშუალება არ ეძლევა ასადის რეჟიმის რეალურ ოპონენტებს. კენჭისღრა მხოლოდ არმიის მიერ კონტროლირებულ რეგიონებში ტარდება. სირიაში სამწლიან სამოქალაქო ომში 60,000-ზე მეტი ადამიანი დაიღუპა. მილიონობით იძულებულია და იძულებული იყო დაეტოვებინა საცხოვრებელი ადგილი. ახლა ცნობები საქართველოზე. შვეიცარიის პრეზიდენტის დიდიე ბურქჰალტერის განცხადებით, ელთოს თავმჯდომარეობის პერიოდში შვეიცარია ვალდებულებას იღებს მხარი დაუჭიროს საქართველოს კონფლიქტის შედეგად დასარელებულთა უფლებებსა და საჭიროებებზე ორიენტირებაში. ბურქჰალტერმა ამ შინაარსის განცხადება გააკეთა დღეს საქართველოში ვიზიტისას. ის ერგნეთში გაეცნო ინციდენტების პრევენციის და მათზე რეაგირების ჯგუფების მუშაობას. ბურქჰალტერმა აღნიშნა, რომ დიალოგი და ნდობის ჩამოყალიბება შვეიცარიის, როგორც ეუთოს თავმჯდომარე ქვეყნის ერთ-ერთი პრიორიტეტია, ისევე როგორც ადამიანების ცხოვრების დონის გაუმჯობესება. მისივე შეფასებით, ინციდენტების პრევენციისა და მათზე რეაგირების მექანიზმი ნათელი მაგალითია იმისა, თუ როგორ შეიძლება ამ იდეების ხორცშესხმა. შვეიცარიის პრეზიდენტმა იმედი გამოთქვა, რომ მსგავსი მექანიზმის მუშაობა გალის მიმართულებითაც განახლდება. დღესვე თბილისში გამართება საქართველოს პრეზიდენტის გიორგი მარგველაშვილის შეხვედრა ეუთოს მორიგე თავმჯდომარე ქვეყნის შვეიცარიის პრეზიდენტთან. გამართება მათი ერთობლივი პრესკონფერენციაც. ეს იყო ახალი ამბების გამოშვება, რომელიც მარიამ ჭიაურელმა მოამზადა და გაგაცნოთ. ლაპარაკობს რადიო თავისუფლება.
Welcome to Roots and Branches on VOA Music Mix. I'm Catherine Cole in Washington, and I am very happy to welcome singer and songwriter Daryl Scott back to the Roots studio. It's been a long, long time. Get us started with a song, please.
Absolutely. I'll start with one off of that record right there. This is called Hopkinsville.
If you can't find work, work finds you. You know daddy didn't raise no welfare fool. Says there's a lot worse things a boy could do than straddle an iron beam. So I'll build this bridge till it's complete, and I'll take the steel toes off my feet and get myself a one-way seat on that train to Hopkinsville. Hey, I'm going back to Hopkinsville. I'm going back, you know I will. Only 21 working days until I'm with my love in Hopkinsville. Blind so the foreman won't see my taste for the wine, and I drink until the sun don't shine, and I sit and drink some more. I might call the boys and deal a hand, may go to town to hear a country band and lie about what we got planned when we get off of that bridge. Hey, I'm going back to Hopkinsville. I'm going back, you know I will. Only 21 working days until I'm with my love in Hopkinsville. Dark, you can see the sun and the welding sparks, and it sounds real good singing old Joe Clark, long as nobody else can hear. And it fits my head, fits my face, and it holds my welding gloves in place. And it's been known to hide the trace of a lonely man crying. Hey, I'm going back to Hopkinsville. I'm going back. No, I will. Only 21 working days until I'm with my love in Hopkinsville. Hey, I'm going back. Hey, I'm going back. You know I will. Only 21 working days until I'm with my love in Hopkinsville. Hopkinsville.
Daryl Scott is here. The song Hopkinsville. Is that a new one?
You know, it's an old one. So Hopkinsville, I bet I wrote that 17, 18 years ago.
Because the songs on this CD come from varying times in your career.
Yeah, so, and mainly yesteryear.
Yesteryear.
Yeah, older stuff, largely because they're all very, to me, very country songs.
And that's what you grew up listening to.
Yeah, I grew up on that stuff. And so through the 60s and 70s, you know, that's what I listened to. I mean, in the distance, you know, was pop or rock radio of the Beatles or whatever, Three Dog Night of Chicago and all that stuff. But at home with my dad or mom, you know, or if you're in the car or truck with them, there's only one thing, and that's country music.
Today we call it classic country music, but that really back then there was just country music.
Yeah, I grew up on stuff like... I mean, certainly George Jones, Merle Haggard, Johnny Cash, Hank Williams.
The Kings.
All, yeah, mm-hmm. And Queens, too, like, you know,
Loretta.
Dolly Parton, Loretta.
Mm-hmm.
My mom, of course, liked the women singers, and my dad liked the males. So I got a pretty good country music education from those two.
Now, for everybody that wasn't here or listening the last time that you were in, let's take a little nutshell biography. You've been playing music a long, long time. I mean, since you were a kid.
That picture right there on the cover, I mean, I don't have a guitar in my hand, but probably that night I did.
And you were maybe 12 then, 10?
Could be 8.
8?
10, 12, I can't, mm-hmm. I don't know exactly, but I've been playing since I was 6. And I come from a family band, you know, my dad and brothers and all that, so that's kind of all I ever did. The trouble was never to make a living at music. I always could do that, even as a 12-year-old mm-hmm. or 14-year-old. I mean, whatever living, you know, you would make as a 12-year-old. But, I mean, I could make money at gigs, but the thing was always trying to make money at music I really liked. You know, you could play weddings and bar mitzvahs and VFW halls on Saturday night, mm-hmm. and I did all of that. Growing up, but it felt like the move from Boston, which was 20 years ago now, to Nashville, that was sort of the move of really doing my original music.
Now, when you went off to Boston, though, if I remember correctly, you weren't making music.
I had a period there of going to school, you know, for 4.5 years, where I was in an anti-music stage or something.
You'd already done that.
I'd already done that since, you know, so there I was at 23. So I've been doing that since I was 6 and certainly making a living, making money at it since I was 15 or 16. Mm-hmm. So
you turned to poetry.
Yeah, right? And then I turned, basically an English major. Especially poetry, that's what was kind of calling out. And little did I know, I mean, you'd almost think it was a plan, but I was not aware of a plan that I would study poetry and then turn it back to songs, mm-hmm. you know. I just thought I was kind of saying goodbye to music as I had known it, which I really actually think I was.
Did the people around you know of your musical history then?
Some did. I mean, when I moved to Boston, which no one knew me around mm-hmm. there at all, which is why I chose it, is because I wanted to start new with no story or history or expectation of whatever had been expected of me prior to that. For example, it was expected of me to play music,
mm-hmm.
for example. And while I did play music when I got to Boston, I didn't take it seriously. I just would do it for, to be a college student, and there was an easy way to make some money on a Friday or Saturday night. I never confused it with, now I'm, you know, me okay. and that band are going to go make it big. It was just always.
And did people cash. At the time, anybody say to you at the time, you know, Daryl, perhaps this is your calling?
Oh, I've been told it was my calling since I was a child. You mean music as a child?
Well, yeah, I meant, you know, here you came into Boston, people didn't know that you had been a musician. Didn't know of your past life as a musician.
Yeah.
Did people come up to you and say, hey, did you ever think about doing this?
Yeah, sure. And I guess if they knew enough, I would let them know, like, well, no, I've actually been doing this all mm-hmm. along. And I'm in a period of not wanting to do that, so leave me alone.
Right, you know, let me be a student.
Yeah, let me be a student. Let me be in the theater, you know. Mm-hmm. Let me be in the poetry classes, you know. Let me be non-music for a while. And I'll tell you what, it was important. It was a great period because I sort of gave myself permission to not have to do what seemed to be, you know, pretty well strapped on to me as what I was going to be doing for my life. So when I did come back to it, it seemed to be my choice as opposed to, you know, you can go down a road for a while feeling it was your parents, this or that, or the, you know, you grew up playing music with your brothers. So, you know, that's what you're going to do, right, forever. And for some reason, those 4.5 years of school, college, mm-hmm. up in the Boston area, and I started at a community college, Middlesex Community College, mm-hmm. and transferred into Tufts University. And those years were huge, monumental years, because they didn't have the burden of me having to play music.
No expectations.
No, all I had to do was suddenly be a good student for a change.
Seems, you know, a lot easier.
Yeah, yeah. And so then when I did come back out of college, you know, I thought about going to get a master's degree in poetry, actually,
mm-hmm.
Or creative writing. Instead, though, I was looking at the songs that I was writing, and they started being like, these sound like me, you know, where I think prior to that, I would see little inklings of a verse or a chorus that would sound like me, like the internal me, you mm-hmm. know, like the real me, the essence me. But it was those songs that I started writing in college, and I know it was based on the literature I was reading and poetry and all that stuff, that they sounded like, you know, absolutely me. And now there was, like, no denying. I was like, okay, well, I can go forward on this. And it doesn't have to feel the burden style thing that I had somehow come to be familiar with through my childhood and early 20s. Mm-hmm. So then I'm out of school. Let's see, I'm probably in my late 20s, 28, 29, something like that, and enjoying the songs I'm writing. And then now they're more literate or something. That freedom I found in poetry was sitting in the songs a bit, whether it was characters or ways of writing or something like that. And so it was like, well, geez, I'll follow that, you know, and do less bar mitzvahs and,
right,
and weddings and, you know, stuff, just, you know, honky-tonk nights. Mm-hmm. I started, you know, I guess, walking down the path of, you know, doing my own stuff.
And at that point, you were heading towards Nashville? Which is not really where people think of going to be themselves.
Well, you know what? I didn't want to go to Nashville. I mean, first of all, I lived in Nashville when I was in fifth grade and seventh grade. We moved around a lot. Mm-hmm. And so there was one time in fifth grade, I started the fifth grade year in Nashville.
And then we were 10 years old then, between 10 and 12.
Right.
For people, because other educational systems have a different... trying to place you age.
Sure, sure.
So I was 10 years old,
yeah.
About 9, 10.
And then we moved away. Mm-hmm. And then I moved back there for a summer when I was about 14, 13 or 14, because country music has always been a draw to my family. Mm-hmm. My dad, you know, there couldn't be a more fan or even practitioner of country music. He wrote really good, strong, old-style country music. You know, I always say we couldn't have been more into country music if we'd have been members of the Opry. I mean, we honestly could not have. So that's why Nashville was always the draw and the attraction. Mm-hmm. But also I knew that it was also the very thing that if you really did have your own writer's voice or your own artistic self, that you could walk into Nashville and they would whittle it away from you. And mm-hmm. next thing you know, you're as unimportant as you ever were.
Homogenized, yeah. And just like,
yeah,
the guy next to
you. And it just doesn't matter. Yeah, there's nothing that stands out. So I knew that. So mm-hmm. I didn't want to go to Nashville as an adult until I was very solidly into what I knew was my thing, my path, mm-hmm. so that I couldn't be talked out of it or, you know, contracted out of it or successed out of it.
That makes a huge difference.
Well, I think it was the age. Uh-huh. I think had I been there in Nashville in my early 20s, I don't know what would have happened. I might have just been successful as the lead guitarist for Del Reeves or who knows what, you know. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And just be a road guy.
You wouldn't have had your voice.
No. I think something was more wise than I was. Life kind of put me up in Boston. You know, and I'm not from Boston. I didn't know anyone from there, and that's why I was there. So I got to sort of start again. But when I did start again, I started putting in, you know, only in retrospect can I say this, I started putting in pieces that I already knew, which was music and songs, mm-hmm. along with these things that I discovered up there, which was poetry and, you know, theater and creative, outspoken folks and views and people. And I just started throwing
yourself.
Yeah, really, in essence, that... I knew that I didn't want to come to Nashville, where you could be talked out of yourself, until I really had a self in which to stand up and be counted for, I guess.
Uh-huh. So, and the strength to stay that way.
Yeah. And some of the folks I knew when I got to Nashville were real strong folks. I mean, Guy Clark was one of four people that I knew. Mm-hmm. Sam Bush was one of four people. A guy named Bill Miller was one of four people I knew, and the other was Verlin Thompson. And every single of those folks are absolutely who they are. And you know what I mean?
Absolutely. It's indelible. When you see them, mm-hmm. you couldn't mistake them for anybody else,
yeah.
But you also couldn't imagine anybody imposing their will upon them.
Exactly. So there's where I started. Mm-hmm. So those are the people I knew. So I knew to gravitate toward that individual kind of... dignified.
Yeah, that's a good word.
Kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
That can't be talked out of it and won't be. Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be that style of person in my artistic stuff and all that. So I did, I guess. But I didn't do that until, I didn't move to Nashville until I was in my early 30s. Probably 32 or 33, something like that. So then I've just been doing the you know, what I take as an independent streak of writing and putting out records and mm-hmm. all that ever since. And I've been there 20 years now.
And you've been lucky that other people seem to like your songs, too.
Yeah, I have been lucky with that. When I got to town, you know, being the player that I was, I could get on sessions and I started getting in on demos and there's that money thing again. But what I really wanted to do was my own music. Mm-hmm. And that was happening too because I was writing songs and I started to put together my first record, which was Theater of the Unheard. And
right. Which has a whole story about it. I think that might be one of the ones we talked about the last time you were here.
I'll bet.
That had
yeah.
your original songs mm-hmm. re-recorded.
Oh, that was one called Theater of the Unheard.
Oh, okay. Theater of the... What was the first one?
Aloha from Nashville was
right,
the first.
Okay.
But what was supposed to be the first were those songs off of Theater of the Unheard. And basically, it was one of those things when I was up in Boston, before I moved to Nashville, I got a record deal. With, in essence, a New York pop label.
Mm-hmm.
And then so here I was, this singer-songwriter on a pop label that they didn't know what to do with. Because it's always, when it comes to some of that big business style stuff, it's always about how to break an act that's unknown into the known.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, it's a business thing. I always sort of think of it as like if you had a new ketchup, you know, how would you get, you know, the country to buy your
right.
ketchup,
it's
you know?
Marketing, marketing, marketing.
Right. So I didn't fit the marketing strategy. So they let me go, but I couldn't re-record those songs.
So they languished.
Yeah, they sat in mm-hmm. solitary confinement.
Until you were able to spring them years later.
Yeah.
And give them
yeah.
your twist at the time.
I'll bet that's the record
mm-hmm.
I last came in here on.
And, the, you know, the same thing, in a way, kind of happened to Sean Camp.
Uh-huh.
With a record that I believe was the follow-up to his first album, which sold okay. And
uh-huh.
the second record sat in a vault for 20 years until somebody put it out.
Yeah, we all have those stories. See, that's mm-hmm. the thing I found. You know, there's nothing unique to that story of for Sean or for me or Verlin or Guy or Bill or Sam and on and on and on. All of our friends... we all have those stories. It's almost one of the things, among others, that bind us together is because this isn't an easy way to go. And if you're in it for the easy ride, you're going to just go away very quickly.
Right.
But if you're in this for the long haul, and those are the artists that I admire, it's the lifetime artists. Leonard Cohen is a lifetime artist, I'm certain of it, mm-hmm. and Johnny Cash was, and Hank Williams for his short life. I mean, Merle Haggard's still out there doing it, you know, and on and on. So it becomes a lifetime calling as opposed to, you know, something you do while you're, you know, fit and young and and whatever you are when you're younger.
It's something you have to do, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Like, it just wouldn't be the same without it, you know. And so then we all have those stories
mm-hmm.
of, you know, the failed album or the record company tying us up and, you know, binding us like Houdini for, you know, 9 years or 7 years or 13 or this, that, and the other. But Sean becomes, we all become actually better artists. Mm-hmm. Not because of, you know, thankful to the... you know, the corporate thing that tied us up, but in spite of the that tied us up.
Earlier in our conversation, we talked a bit about the fact that other Nashville performers also like singing Daryl's songs. He's written hits for Travis Tritt and Brad Paisley, just to name two. And, of course, the Dixie Chicks had a huge hit with his Long Time Gone. Take a listen to Daryl's version on Roots and Branches.
Sits on the front porch swinging, looking out on a vacant field. Used to be filled with burl at her back, and now he knows it never will. Brothers found work in Indiana, sister's a nurse at the old folks' home. Mama's still cooking too much for supper. Me, I've been a long time gone. Been a long time gone. Ain't hold a rose since I don't know when. Long time gone. And it ain't coming back again. Now Julia plays that old church piano. picture sitting out on her daddy's farm. She always thought we'd be together. Lord, I never meant to do her harm. Since she could hear me singing in the choir, me, I heard another song. I got wind and hit the road running. Lord, I've been a long time gone. Been a long time gone. I ain't had a prayer since I don't know when. Long time gone, and it ain't coming back again. Nashville, trying to be the big deal, playing down on Broadway, getting out of Hardway, living from a tip jar, sleeping in my car, rocking my guitar. Yeah, I'm gonna be a star. Now me and Delia sing every Sunday, watching the garden and the children grow. We listen to the radio to hear what's cooking, but the music ain't got no soul. No. They sound tired, but they don't sound haggard. They got money, but they don't have cash. They got Junior, but they don't have Hank. I think the rest is a long time gone. Though I ain't off the horn since I don't know when. Long time gone, and it ain't coming back again. Yeah, I ain't off the horn since I don't know when. Long time gone, and it ain't coming back again. Well, long time, long time gone. Lord, it's been a long time. Yeah, long time, long time, long time gone. Lord, it's been a long time.
Scott singing Long Time Gone on Roots and Branches. We will be back with more music and conversation in just a second. I am Catherine Cole. This is Roots and Branches on the VOA Music Mix Network.
Thank you.
Hello again from Washington. I'm Catherine Cole. This is Roots and Branches on VOA Music Mix. This hour, I am visiting with Daryl Scott, and I think it's time for another song.
I am grounded. Oh, but I have wings to fly. I don't use them. I just look up in the sky. I keep them hidden. Bound up in a coat and tie. Till the world is ready for a man with wings to fly. But I will fly someday. I'll break these feet of clay. Then I'll be on my way, my way. I am feeling, though I do not shed a tear, my eyes are dusty. Though I have faced my fear of fears, I am shaken by the coming on of years. I am a feeling man, but I cannot shed a tear. Oh, but I will cry someday. I'll break these eyes of clay. Then I'll be on my way, my way. Someday. Make my bed alone. I've had lovers, but I have no one of my own. But I could feed her from the garden I have grown. I am a loving man, but I make my bed alone. Oh, but I will love someday. I'll break this heart of clay, and I'll be on my way, yes, my way, and I will fly someday. I'll break these feet and this heart and these eyes of clay. Be on my way, someday.
Daryl Scott's new CD is Long Ride Home. That guitar sounds absolutely fabulous. And
thank
I know
you. It does,
someone's,
doesn't it?
Someone's
going to
ask me about it.
Yeah,
so can you tell us about it?
It's kind of the Holy Grail. A guy named Stefan Sobel out of near Newcastle, England, makes this.
It's just amazing.
Yeah, it's a very balanced guitar. It's not too heavy low end. Mm-hmm. It's not too tinny and shiny bright end. Or just a mid-range honk. It's just this balanced piece of art. Stefan Sobel is one of our best makers on the planet, honestly.
And it travels well, that guitar. I mean, I would be afraid to take it with me.
I should be, you know, but there's my case over there. And it's,
which is,
you know,
hard. It's a big yellow travel case.
It's yellow so I can see it, you know, and know that I haven't left it at a gig. And then it's, you know, got a nice outer case. I mean, those cases are as good as it gets. So, yeah, I try to... try to take care of it, you know, but I don't baby these things. They're tools, but you don't want to mistreat your tools.
Do you play every day?
No, I try not to.
Mm-hmm.
I never practice.
Never?
No. I play a lot. That's my trouble. You know, a lot of gigs or
studio stuff.
Yeah, less studio than it used to be. I mean, I used to be a studio call, I guess.
Well, before I knew you, I'd see your name on things. And we're talking, you know, 10, 12, 13 years ago.
I played on lots of stuff, from, you know, Guy Clark. Those were some of my favorite things to do. And, you know, cool stuff like Guy or Steve Earle or things. Or more recently, Robert Plant and the Band of Joy.
I was going to ask you about that. That sort of kept you away from your own stuff for a year or so. You were out on the road. You were the part of the Band of Joy.
Yeah, I tried to do both for a while because I had a new record, Crooked Road is what it was called. And then like a month later, I joined, you know, with Robert. But it was... And I was aware of, you know, like, well, geez, I just put out a record. You know, I know I'm supposed to stay with my own record and all that. But
how would you say no to Robert Plant? I mean...
I didn't. I mean, there is a way to say no, but I didn't.
I'm sure you must have said no at times, but, you know.
Well, it was Robert and it was Buddy Miller and Patty Griffin and Byron House and Marco Giovino. And it was just a good band. And it was a very soulful band and a very unique band and a very unique time to do it. And it was like, even though I just had out a record, what I had to know was that I would still come back to records. And
yeah,
What's
your
in
own.
Your Hand is an example. You know, that I wasn't stopping my own career I was stopping, turning down the heat on the solo stuff while being in this great opportunity with, you know, one of our great communicators, Robert Plant, you know.
And it was a fabulous album. I didn't get to see the tour, although I saw a couple of songs.
Yeah.
But, it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
And maybe twice. I bet we will do it again.
You'll do it again?
Yeah, I bet we will.
Well, it must be... I mean, I remember Sam Bush and Jerry Douglas both saying to me at different times that every once in a while it's kind of nice to be an employee instead of the employer.
Right. I didn't have to worry about anything. You know, there was somebody taking care of all my instruments, like this very instrument, you know, that we talked
about. You weren't carrying
it
everywhere.
No, I wasn't even tuning it.
You didn't have to make the hotel reservations.
No.
Or stand in line.
Or this and that. Right. And so all you have to do, so it was a nice contrast. And again, knowing I was going to come back to my stuff, of course, just as Patty is, or Buddy and Robert. Too, you know, what I love about Robert, among other things, is he's a moving creative process, and he's a lifetime artist, too.
Yeah, he's not putting himself in a museum because of what he did.
Right.
He's still creating new.
Completely. And so it was fun to be with someone who's done as much wonderful music as Robert and still wants to make new music instead of just, you know, parading around the old thing, you know.
Right.
It was worthy. So I look forward to what we get into next. I'll bet you there's something coming up one of these days.
One of these days, yeah. But in the meantime, we've got a CD to talk about, Long Ride Home, which is different than some of your projects because these are songs that you've culled from various parts of your career, that you wrote some of them when you were a kid.
Yeah, two of them when I was 16 with my dad.
Was that something you did much of?
No, that's why it was sort of a standout. One weekend, we were living in Southern California. He rented a cabin up in Big Bear Lake, up in the San Bernardino Mountains. And it was just the two of us. And he rented it for the specific reason for us to go write songs. So there I was, 16, with my dad, you know, at a cabin. And he had a song started called The Country Boy, which is on this record. And I helped him finish it. And I had a song started called You're Everything I Wanted Love to Be, that he helped me finish up on that weekend. That's how far back these songs, two of these songs go. Others are from my early 20s or late 20s or when I first moved to Nashville. But really what I would say about all these songs is that they're very country. The reason that they're sitting on this album is that they're country songs. Country like I grew up on. So what I did was cast the players on this record as some of the folks who played in the 60s and 70s.
I was going to mention that. I mean, these are household names, if you read the back of records.
If you read the back of records in the 60s and 70s of country music, these are some of those names. Pig Robbins, Hargis Pig Robbins on piano. That's the thing about what gets known as country or Nashville musicians. They're just great musicians. They're not just great country musicians.
Yes.
So Pig also played on Dylan's Nashville Skyline, and Lloyd Green on Pedal Steel played with Farron Young back in the late 50s. These kinds of guys. You know, Mickey Raphael on harmonica, who plays with Willie. And so these were the guys I called, right? So, of course, it's going to sound classic. So I had a ball, you know, playing with those guys. They were my heroes. And I, too, would read the back of albums.
Didn't we all?
Yeah.
I mean, that's how you learned about stuff.
Yeah, and then cross-pollinated, you know. Mm-hmm. Oh, so there's Pig playing on Merle Haggard. Look over here, he's playing with Charlie Rich. And
right, maybe I better listen to this because I like the way he plays.
Exactly.
And then you learn, then you go back in time. And
right, all that.
Was there anybody that was the one that got away that you really just couldn't pin down?
No.
No? Oh, you're so lucky.
Yeah, I know. Plus, I didn't throw a giant net. You know, I didn't look toward another steel player. It was Lloyd Green. I played steel on half the record, but there was a sound I was looking for that I knew I can't play, and it's classic Lloyd Green.
So who else to get? I mean, but Lloyd Green.
Right. There's other great steel players, but you won't get Lloyd.
No.
Unless you get Lloyd.
You know? Exactly.
And so Pig, same thing. I mean, there are other keyboard players, but no one has really almost even the history of country piano playing as Pig Robbins. They just... The closest second would be a guy named Floyd Kramer.
Oh, yeah,
And then Floyd started on, you know, having a solo career with songs that he played, like Last Date and things. So he's doing less. He did less sessions. Well, there's Pig, you know, playing everything. There was no replacement for Pig. There wouldn't be one. Dennis Crouch on bass. Now, Dennis is a contemporary guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, Dennis, you know, was a baby in the 60s and the 70s and all that kind of thing. But he studied that style of bass playing. I mean, Dennis comes from, you know...
He comes from a music family.
Yeah.
You know, he's got his brother and everybody else. And
you know, Dennis is playing, you know, these days in the last 5 years, he's played with Elvis Costello, he's played with Elton John, and, you know, it's crazy what Dennis has done, but where he comes from is the roots of country music, and I know that because Dennis and I were in the Steve Earle and the Bluegrass Dukes. So I knew to call Dennis because he would play the old style,
right?
Which is copying the left hand of Pig Robbins. That's basically what the old country.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're locked as if they're telepathic. I mean, that's the old style, you know, of the left hand of the piano and the upright bass doing the runs right into the chorus or
Is there
or all
a song on here that really shows that off?
It's all over the place.
Okay.
Certainly Hopkinsville is filled with it. It's Too Close to Comfort would be another one. That's the old style. That's where the upright bass player would follow the left hand of the piano, and they'd work it out. So, you know, between takes or while they're learning it, they're talking about their approach because their approach is going to be identical. And that's what the old style of left-hand bass on the piano and the upright bass is. Yeah, that would be a good one.
Okay, we'll play that one right now.
Yeah.
In a bar, in a hotel, in Atlanta downtown, he's a long way from home, and he's poured him down. There's a lady in waiting, a warm midnight friend. Oh, but it's that sweet southern comfort again. It's cool conversation, it's courage in a glass. He don't tell her he's married, and she don't even ask. Just living for the moment, let the good times begin. Oh, he got too close to comfort again. Nobody wins. Oh, he eightfold step inside to lay down an impression that's sweeter than sin. Oh, but it's that sweet, sweet southern comfort again. And he looks in the mirror in the cold morning light, and he stares at a young man with age in his eyes. He started this dance, but the song has no end. No, he got too close to comfort again. Sweet southern comfort, crossing the line, lying with strangers one more last time. Genius or gay, where nobody wins. No, he got too close to comfort.
So is this the type of record that you wanted to make when you first got to Nashville? Was
No.
What was in your head? No?
No. No, this record took all these years to sort of be comfortable with going back to old country, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the only thing I can think of. Now it's, I guess, to give honor to where I come from, mm-hmm. musically. And, you know, let's face it, you're trying to get away from your childhood sometimes. And there's a point at which some people, I guess, get on with it early and just, and never have a problem with it. But I, you know, I had a, I guess, some kind of problem with, not a full problem, but just, you know, like even being from Kentucky, it takes a while to where you're proud of that as opposed to the thing you kind of tuck behind on the schoolyard, you know, when you're in California. I remember lying to a kid on the playground, what music do you listen to, he asked, and the last thing I would tell him is country music, because, you know, the general hip thing is, you know,
just
pop and
cool.
Rock.
Yeah.
Right, and it's not cool, so you better not say it. You know, you learn to not speak Southern when you're not in the South,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Sure, because people think of you a certain way
right.
when they hear you speak that way.
So I noticed that none of my brothers sound, none of us sound like we're from Kentucky. But
not at all.
But our family roots, I guarantee you, are as Kentucky as Loretta Lynn's mm-hmm. is Kentucky. That's kind of normal, especially for those who kind of get away, so to speak, and move on to, I mean, basically what happened, a lot of folks from the South moved to the North, right?
Yes.
To work in Detroit car factories.
In here. Actually,
yeah, absolutely.
A lot in Washington and Baltimore. Anywhere there were jobs.
Really. Right, and they brought their music with them. Mm-hmm. They brought their food and culture. But sometimes, you know, you'd learn, it's almost an unspoken way sometimes, to hide that thing you come from so that you can fit into the North if you're from the South, right?
Right.
And so I was aware of that, and I can't say that I took speaking lessons of how to not be Southern, but it is kind of odd that me and my brothers don't sound like we're from Kentucky.
What about when you all get together, do you?
No.
Never.
No, I don't know why. Someone with a PhD would have to tell me why people with roots in something mm-hmm. lose their tongue within a generation. I'd love to know more about that. But it happens. And it's not just my family. And it's
no.
It's kind of the way it is, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, let me get one more song out of you before we let you go.
Okay. Let's see. Let me see that record
okay.
again.
There you go.
It'll jog my memory.
You can play anything. It doesn't have to be from that record. Anything you feel like playing.
Okay. Anything, huh?
Anything.
Okay, well then.
Something you just want to play.
Okay, well then I'll do this.
This is my favorite part, when somebody plays a song they really want to play.
Well, we were talking about losing your tongue, mm-hmm. right? Your Southern accent. You know, Tom Petty has a great song called Southern Accent about that subject.
Yes.
on that subject, that reminds me of this song, which I'll do for you here. It's called Passing. So it's the idea of passing. Where the idea came from was an article I read in Oklahoma about a Cherokee woman who was, half Cherokee and half white. The article was about trying to be Cherokee enough when she was with the Cherokee folks to where they'd accept her as a Cherokee, and trying to be white enough when she's with the white friends to not have that Cherokee thing among, you know, the trip to the mall or whatever, right, with teenage kids. And so I started thinking about that, and since we're talking about it, I'll do this song called Passing. There's an ancient wind blowing across the rolling hills tonight. The sun is setting red in Oklahoma. And I have come back here to earn a dime and sing a song or two and bear witness in this big world I've been roaming. I remember Mom and Dad working in the red dirt fields. My childhood, the fear of hellfire everlasting. And Dad only speaking Cherokee by the light of black and white TV. I didn't know it then, but we were passing, just passing. I was born into Kentucky, Kentucky's born into me. From Scott Irish blood, or so they tell me. White Southerner American, landowner of the free, has always felt like words they tried to sell me. And I learned to hide my Southern tongue up in the great white north. Spoke when spoken to or when they asked me. And I showed up to the job on time. You minded yours, I minded mine. But time was not the only thing passing. I too was passing. Passing. And what is passing? When your black tries to white, and your white tries to black, and you're broken on the inside from everything you lack. When your love turns to hate, and your hate turns to please, when you're running from yourself, oh, it'll bring you to your knees. That is passing. Woman with a paintbrush in my hand, coloring the shadows that still haunt me. Men in white hoods, do good, sad-eyed Jesus ruled my neighborhood. You can send your Satan now if he wants me. But every morning I'm awakened by possibility. No angry God is welcome at my door. And I know that I stand for more than you can see. Oh, I will not lie in silence anymore. And I know that I am dying. I know you are dying too. The soul that we've encased comes unfastened. And we fall and we fly forever to the great unknown. Hallelujah, Jubilee, we are passing. And we will only be remembered for the one we came to be. Hallelujah, Jubilee, we are passing.
There's an ancient wind blowing across the rolling hills tonight. Fade out.
Oh, spectacular.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming in today. I have a lot of more questions, and I know you've got a lot more songs, so you're going to have to come back.
I'll have to come back.
Relatively soon.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Daryl Scott. Please let me know if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard today. My email is roots@voa.gov, and that is spelled roots@voa.gov. I'm Catherine Cole. This is Roots and Branches on the VOA Music Mix Network.
Ukuret GMG's XCVR's interactive regime. Sami sportuli da sami kino archi. Kadakhvebis funktsiit mkholod Silk TV-shi. Silk TV. 15 laridan. Dareket da daregistrirdi.